Welcome, everybody. Welcome to today's episode of The Law of Self-Defense. I am, of course, attorney Andrew Branca for The Law of Self-Defense. Come on in. Come on in. Make yourselves comfortable. We have a very interesting show for everybody. Hannah Gutierrez, the armorer on the set of the low-budget Western movie Rust, was found guilty of involuntary manslaughter for the death of Helena Hutchins. The theory of the state's case, which the jury concluded was proven beyond any reasonable doubt, is that as armorer, Helena Hutchins loaded a live round into a single action Army Colt revolver, handed that revolver onto the set as a cold gun, and that revolver would then be used to shoot and kill Helena Hutchins and wound, who was the cinematographer on the set, and wound Joel Souza, the director on the set. She is now booked. She is booked. I thought I had pulled up. This is her. Booked yesterday, directly in remanded to jail by Judge Morrow. So her case is done, except for sentencing, which is supposed to happen sometime in April. Today, however, we're here to talk about not her, but about the man who held the gun that fired the round, the gun loaded by Hannah Gutierrez that fired the round that killed Helena Hutchins. And that man, of course, is the actor Alec Baldwin. And we're taking a sneak peek at what we should expect in his prosecution, which is coming up soon. Now, I will note, I think a lot of people are mistaken about the date of Alec Baldwin's trial. I keep hearing July 9th. But this is the document I have from the court trial scheduling order, which was filed on February 6th. So not that long ago, only about a month ago. It says there's a docket call for July 9th, meaning the lawyers have to appear before the judge on July 9th. And the last day for a change of plea is July 22nd. Well, obviously the trial can't be in progress at that point. And then it says pick and go trial dates for this matter are set for August 6th at 8:30 a.m. By the way, the docket call is 1:30 p.m. It's not likely they would begin a trial on the first day after lunch. So I think that's just a last meeting between the lawyers and the judges, not the start date of the trial. I believe the start date of the trial is August 6th, 2024 at 8:30 a.m., which time the attorneys and the defendant shall appear for their specific days of trial. That makes a lot more sense to me. So I could be mistaken, but honestly, I think a lot of journalists just read this July 9th date and assumed that was the start of the trial. I think they're mistaken. I think it's August 6th. But I will attempt to clarify as we move forward. Hey, folks, a quick correction to the scheduling and judge assignment information I just shared. A law self-defense member, an attorney down the area, was reached out to me to provide me with the correct information on all this. So I wanted to share that with all of you to correct the mistaken information I just shared with you. Now, first, we have the judge assignment. So Judge Ellington had been assigned to the Alec Baldwin trial, but he's now been excused from the case, and Judge Morrow will be the trial judge. The same judge we had in the Hannah Gutierrez trial will be the judge in the Alec Baldwin trial. So that was the first thing I wanted to correct. The second had to do with scheduling. So discovery order and trial scheduling, lots of stuff about when things will come and go. But if we scroll all the way down, we get explicit about the trial. The second issue I wanted to address was around the scheduling. I had shown you some court documents that had some scheduling information. In fact, we have more recent information. This from the 26th of February. It's a scheduling order, as we can see here, and it has lots of little details, but I'll just get to the part about when the trial is to start. Discovery needs to be completed, witness list, all that kind of stuff, pretrial conference. And let's see. Jury selection is scheduled for July 9th, 2024, and the trial is estimated to last 8 days between July 10th and July 19th. So that is the corrected scheduling information. All right, folks, back to the remainder of this show, a sneak peek at what we can expect during the Alec Baldwin trial. Sorry for the errors. I'm glad to correct it. And thanks to Mike, who brought this stuff to my attention. So that's what we're going to talk about today, is the prospective merits of the Alec Baldwin prosecution. I have statute, I have jury instruction, I have case law, all New Mexico, of course, and we have the effectively undisputed facts of this case. So, having said all that, let's go ahead and launch the formal start of today's show. All right, so before we jump into all the things, I do, of course, have to mention our sponsor of today's show, which is none other than CCW Safe, a provider of legal service memberships, what many people mistakenly call self-defense insurance. CCW Safe promises to pay their members criminal legal defenses and provide civil liability coverage if their member is involved in a use of force event, compelled to use force to defend themselves, their family, or property. Folks, these costs get very big, very fast. The cases I consult on, not uncommon. The killing cases, the manslaughter, the murder cases, not uncommon for the defense to run up $200,000 in legal expenses before they get to trial. So unless you have that kind of money stuffed in your mattress, just in case you're attacked, it can be helpful to have the financial backing of an organization like CCW Safe. We'd all like to think we live in a world where the amount of resources, the amount of money you can bring to your legal defense doesn't affect the justice that you get, but I can assure you it does. It's just like any other war. The more resources you can bring to the battle, the more likely you are to win. And CCW Safe provides effectively unlimited resources for your legal defense in criminal court. Not only that, their national trial counsel who consults on your case is attorney Don West, one of the attorneys for George Zimmerman, a world-class criminal defense lawyer. Any defense team that has Don West advising, consulting, is head and shoulders above it. That same team without him. They have a team of their own investigators that work for you, retired homicide detectives, very experienced, who are flown into the scene to act as your investigator so that it's not a case where the only investigators work for the prosecution, which is normally the case. And they have a lot more other benefits. In fact, I think so much as CCW Safe, not only do I do a lot of partnering with them, but I am personally a member of CCW Safe. My wife, Emily, is personally a member. I trust CCW Safe. I don't trust some of their competitors. Some of their competitors out there in the marketplace, even very big ones, are utterly untrustworthy, in my opinion. Their products, their service is hot garbage, cannot be trusted. Now, you don't want to waste your money on one of those. None of these plans are inexpensive. They're all hundreds of dollars a year. Good value if you can count on them to actually carry through on what they promise. Unfortunately, you can't do that with every company purporting to offer this kind of coverage. I trust CCW Safe. If you'd like to learn why I trust CCW Safe specifically, I have a little video, 2-3 minutes you can watch at lawofselfdefense.com/trust. And also there you can get a discount code for 10% off your membership at CCW Safe when you join me there as a member. Again, that's lawofselfdefense.com/trust. All right. Now, let's dive into what we've got. So what are the facts? The facts of the Alec Baldwin shooting of Helena Hutchins. Well, he was holding the gun that fired the shot that killed Helena Hutchins. That's undisputed. The bullet that killed Helena Hutchins came out of his gun. undisputed, and it was the bullet that caused her death, also undisputed. So could Alec Baldwin have any legal defense against a criminal charge for the unlawful killing of Helena Hutchins? In theory, he could, and I want to put this out of the way right at the front, because in fact, it doesn't exist. But in theory, we know that there was a replica version of Alec Baldwin's revolver, the dedicated revolver. It was unique to his character in the movie. Had a substantially longer barrel than similar revolvers being used by other actors in the movie. We know there was a replica of Alec Baldwin's revolver. So his real revolver is a real gun that can fire real ammo, obviously, because that's what happened here. The replica looks identical to his gun. And it'll function in the sense that you can cock the hammer, you can drop the hammer with the trigger, the cylinder will turn, you can load rounds or dummy rounds, I guess, into the chamber, but it cannot fire a live round. So it's harmless. For purposes of functioning as a firearm that can kill, it's inert. But the gun he typically used was not the replica. It was the real version of the gun that can be loaded with live rounds. Those live rounds can be discharged. And if they strike someone, as they struck Helena Hutchins, they can kill, as they killed Helena Hutchins. If immediately, when that gun in Alec Baldwin's hand, in that church, on that set, immediately when it discharged, he had held it up and said, "Oh my God, I thought this was the replica. I had no idea this was a real gun that could actually kill people." If he had said that, and of course, presuming we believed him when he said it, but if he had said that, then that would have left him off the hook, probably, for any criminal liability for the death of Hutchins, because the basis of his liability is that he knowingly created a risk of death, an unjustified risk of death to Helena Hutchins, ignored that risk, and she died as a result. This is the analogy, the classic analogy would be a drunk driving, vehicular homicide death. So someone goes to a bar, they get drunk, they have to drive home, they don't have to, they choose to drive home, and they know if they're driving drunk, they're creating an unjustified risk of death to others in public, but they ignored that risk. Now, they're not intending to run anybody over on the ride home. They're just intending to get home from the bar. But driving drunk on the way home, they run over some old lady in the crosswalk and kill her. That is an involuntary manslaughter. They did not intend to kill, but they acted recklessly in knowing they were creating an unjustified risk of death to others, ignoring that risk, and then death results. That is involuntary manslaughter. The manslaughter, the killing, was not voluntary. It was not intentional. It was involuntary. But because it was based on reckless conduct, it's a criminal offense, not merely some kind of accident. And that's the basis for Alec Baldwin's liability here, that he pointed a real gun at Helena Hutchins, and she died as a result. And if you know it's a real gun, you know it's capable of killing, unless you ensure there's no live ammo in it, which we know he didn't do because a live round fired from the gun. If he had said immediately, "Oh my God, I thought this was the replica," then he could credibly argue, certainly enough to raise a reasonable doubt about guilt, that he didn't know that he was creating an unjustified risk of death to Helena Hutchins when he pointed the gun at her, because he thought it was an inert prop, one not capable of firing a round. The problem with that is Alec Baldwin did something very foolish, and that is he spent an hour plus talking with Santa Fe Sheriff's Office investigators without a lawyer present, was given a Miranda waiver and signed it, and just started talking to the investigators. And I think we'll find, much as we did with Hannah Gutierrez, much of the evidence used to convict Hannah Gutierrez on her involuntary manslaughter charge came from Hannah Gutierrez. In her 3 hours plus of police interrogations, the majority of which were done with a lawyer, her lawyer beside her, who did absolutely nothing, virtually nothing, in the course of that 2 hour plus investigation in which he was present. But in any case, much of the evidence that locked Hannah Gutierrez into a involuntary manslaughter conviction came from her own mouth, recorded on cameras during those police interrogations. And the same is true of Alec Baldwin. For example, the possibility that he could claim that he did not know. He was handling a real firearm. This is about 20, 25 minutes into his hour and 15-minute interview with police. Let's take a look at what he has to say. He's talking here about Hanna's handling of the prop. He calls them prop firearms. Just to be clear, we need to distinguish. There are various kinds of quote-unquote firearms used on a movie set. Some are just inert plastic, no moving parts. They're just rubber guns. Obviously, they can't fire around. Others are replicas that function like a real gun, but for the inability to fire a live round. But mostly, at least the lead actors, use real firearms on movie sets. Real firearms that are capable of firing real bullets. And they know that they're real guns. And dummies are used to replicate the presence of live ammo. Dummy that rattles when you shake it or has a hole drilled in the side or is missing a primer so it can be distinguished from an actual live round. Because obviously you don't want a live round in a gun on a movie set because it could kill somebody, as happened here. So in this context, as this video will make clear, although Baldwin refers to these as props, they're only props in the sense that they're items being used on a set. These are real guns, as he tells investigators, and as the jury will hear right here.
Responsibility to secure the prop weapons.
Everything in there.
Which are real guns. Real guns.
So there goes that excuse by Alec Baldwin. He knew the gun in his hand was real. Which means, because guns are inherently dangerous instruments that all people recognize can cause death or serious bodily injury, particularly Alec Baldwin, by the way, because he's on the board of a gun control organization that exists specifically because the people involved recognize guns as causing death and serious bodily injury. Now, they stupidly want to disarm law-abiding people instead of criminals. But regardless, he can hardly claim he doesn't know guns are dangerous, particularly given he's been in 75 movies, many of them involving firearms, his handling of firearms. He's been trained dozens of times on movie and TV sets about the safe handling of firearms and what risks are incurred when handling real firearms on a movie set. So he certainly cannot claim ignorance of the dangers of real guns. Really, nobody can. Everybody living in a Western nation knows that real guns are dangerous. And he lost a key defense right there. If he'd had a lawyer present, or he'd simply chosen not to speak with police until he had a lawyer present, his lawyer would not have allowed him to make that kind of statement. A good lawyer, a competent lawyer, not a Jason Bowles kind of lawyer. But I expect Alec's lawyers to be substantially better than those that were purporting to represent Hanna Gutierrez. But it's too late for that. He chose to talk for an hour and 15 minutes to investigators, including, of course, Detective Alexandra Hooters Hancock, the lead investigator on this case for both the Hanna Gutierrez trial and for the Alec Baldwin trial as well. So, key defense lost there. So, knowing he had a real gun, what are the relevant facts that are essentially established and for practical purposes, not disputed? There is one fact disputed by Alec Baldwin, but it's so not credible that I don't think it'll be a serious barrier to a conviction in this case. So some of the assumed facts are it was Alec Baldwin who was holding, manipulating the gun that fired the projectile that killed Helena Hutchins. No one is saying some other gun fired the shot, right? It was the gun in his hand. Now, here's the fact that Baldwin disputes. The gun discharged because the trigger was depressed by Alec Baldwin. Now, he says he never pressed the trigger. Two problems with that. One is, although we don't have any video footage of the shooting itself, we do have video footage of Alec Baldwin rehearsing for the motion that would result in the killing of Helena Hutchins. And he's presenting the pistol, the revolver, from a cross-draw holster. And every time he does that in practice, when the gun comes out, he cocks the hammer and his finger is on the trigger. Like here. Like here. Finger on the trigger, obviously, very clear. He lowers the hammer, gets it back in the holster, does another practice, presentation of the revolver. Come on, Alec. There he goes. And the finger on the trigger very clearly again. So first we have to believe that he put the finger on the trigger in while rehearsing, but didn't put his finger on the trigger when the gun actually discharged. Is there reason to believe that's not true? Now, he may believe it's true in his mind, but can a reasonable jury infer that he's mistaken or lying? Of course, especially based on this video. But even more important, we have expert witness testimony, or we will have expert witness testimony, that that can happen, that the gun cannot be discharged without the hammer being dropped. And by the way, in Hannah's trial, we heard that from Luke Haig, the firearms expert for the state in the Gutierrez prosecution. We heard it from the FBI firearms inspector, and that you can't drop the hammer on that gun without pressing the trigger. In fact, to decock it. So in this practice run we just saw, the rehearsal, Alec was cocking the pistol, getting his finger on the trigger, and then to decock, he had to put his finger on the trigger. That's the only way to decock that gun if it's functional, and all the evidence is that at the set, the gun was perfectly functional. By the way, the witnesses against Alec Baldwin for his trial are going to be largely the same as the witnesses were, the state's witnesses, against Hannah Gutierrez. So let's take a quick look at the witness list. Ross Adiego, he testified in the Gutierrez trial. Lieutenant Benavidez, he was the first, oh, not the first, the second sheriff's office officer present. Detective Joel Cano. Brian Carpenter was the well-experienced armorer brought in by the prosecution to talk about how armors should function on a set. Geraldine Conway, one of the FBI investigators, DNA. Robert Gillette, FBI explosives. Corporal Alexandra Fishlips Hooters Hancock, the lead investigator for the sheriff's office on this case. Heather Gerald, the medical examiner. All these people, Deputy Lujan, Seth Kenny, Detective LaFleur, he was the first, at that time, he was a sheriff's deputy. He was the first officer on the scene. Mammy, the script supervisor. Marissa Popple, Santa Fe Sheriff's Office. She took the crime scene photos, evidence photos. Jensen Ackles, that's the actor. So he wasn't in the Gutierrez trial, but apparently he's at least on the witness list for the Care Family Business Beer Companies. I guess he has a beer company. So I thought his name was spelled with two E's. Sherilyn Schaefer, she was the traumatized medic, testified in the first trial. Joel Souza, the director, testified. Sarah Zachary testified. John Zelo testified. Bryce Ziegler was the FBI tool and mark examiner. He's the one that tested the revolver to destruction, but it was working when it arrived at working properly when it arrived. Lorenzo Montoya, that's the OSHA investigator on the state's witness list. Samantha Talamente, I don't remember Talamente. Sam was the Sam was the second detective present in the first interview. So this is Detective Alexandra Hooters Hancock on the left here, and this is Samantha Talamante here on the right. She doesn't stay with the case very long, to my knowledge, but she was involved in the interview of Baldwin. That's why she's here. Let's see. Christina Espinoza, another, she wasn't in the first trial, but I guess she's going to bring some OSHA records. Luke Haig, he was the firearms expert for the state in the Gutierrez trial. Wyatt Mortensen, I don't remember who he is. Lane Looper, the camera guy who quit the night before this tragic event, the evening of October 20th, the camera crew resigned and they picked up all the gear the morning of the 21st, causing a delay in armorer functions the day of the 21st. Mike Primo, Primo, I think it's pronounced. He was the video and photographic enhancement expert who wasn't very impressive in the Gutierrez trial, but nevertheless, he testified. Nathan Klinger, he testified. Shannon Prince, FBI. Leighton Prince testified. Michael Haig. So funny. So Luke Haig was the firearms expert for the state in the Gutierrez trial. He's 80-something years old. Has all his wits. He was very good, very competent on the witness stand. But a number of times he seemed to be promoting his youngest son, Michael, who worked with him on some of this analysis. And now his son, Michael, is on the witness list. So maybe Luke's being a good dad and trying to kind of slide his son, Michael, into the firearms expert witness testimony business. Not a bad thing to do if the son's competent. Hannah Gutierrez is on the witness list for the state, for the Alec Baldwin trial. And now that she's been convicted, can she plead the fifth? I don't know. I mean, she might appeal her conviction. She might say, hey, I'm going to appeal. So I'm still not going to testify against myself. Maybe it could be a factor in sentencing because she's not sentenced till April. Maybe she could cut a deal with the prosecution on sentencing recommendation. Jonah Foxman, I don't know who that is. Gabrielle Pickle, of course, was, I think, a unit line manager, some management position on the set of Rust. Address in Santa Monica. That's her law firm, Santa Monica. So there we are. Now, Kerry Morrissey will be the prosecutor in the Alec Baldwin case as well. Now, I've been saying that Judge Morrow, who was the judge in the Gutierrez case, will be the judge in the Alec Baldwin case, which is normally how it's done. Two very similar cases. The judge is familiar with at least, you know, the prosecution team, familiar with many of the witnesses and the issues in the case and the arguments that are likely to be made. But in fact, I don't think Judge Morrow is going to be on the Alec Baldwin case because on this witness list, the judge listed is Judge Glenn Ellington, also a trial judge in this district. And so there we go. We may have a different judge for the second trial, which means we could get some different rulings on evidence and so forth, which could happen even with the same judge, but tends not to happen if you have the same judge. Okay, so where are we now? Let's get back to discussing the merits, the legal merits. So I talked about Alec was a guy manipulating the gun that fired the projectile that killed Ms. Hutchins. The gun discharged because the trigger was depressed. I think that's incontrovertible. In rehearsal, he's got his finger on the trigger, and the experts are going to testify the gun could not have fired without the trigger being depressed. By the way, if you do cock the gun all the way back, you only need about 2 pounds of pressure on the trigger, which is tiny amount of pressure on the trigger in order for that trigger to be dropped. Inadvertently touching the trigger could easily drop the hammer. The muzzle of the weapon, we have to believe, was directed at Ms. Hutchins by Baldwin when it fired. In other words, she wasn't killed by some kind of unpredictable ricochet. And we know that to be the case. The bullet went through Hutchins into the shoulder of director Joel Souza, was recovered from his shoulder. And while it's imperfect because of the passage through these physical bodies, and maybe if the barrel of the revolver was a bit fouled as well, it still obviously did not ricochet off some hard object that would have been necessary for it to maintain the velocity to kill Hutchins, pass through her completely, and then wound Joel Souza's shoulder. We have to believe the gun contained a live round, which of course is the bullet that killed Hutchins, so it obviously did. We have to believe that Baldwin had the opportunity to inspect the weapon for live ammo before he pointed the muzzle at Hutchins and pressed the trigger. And we know that inspection of this gun takes less than a minute. And you always have a minute on a movie set if you're the lead actor and the producer, the most powerful person on that set, who every witness who testified in the Gutierrez trial, when asked, was Baldwin effectively in charge of that movie set, said yes. So if he'd wanted to inspect the gun, now he could have, if not inspected it himself, the standard would be for the armorer to be called over, the armorer to dump the rounds out of the gun, shake them for everybody so they could hear them rattle, shake them by Baldwin's ear, or show him the hole in the cartridge. There's only six cartridges in her hand. Each of them is checked, and then those six are put back into the gun. That would take a minute. So he had the opportunity to ensure there were no live rounds in the gun, and he did not take it. If you point what you know to be a real gun at another human being and you have not insured, there's no live round, there's no ammo on the gun, are you creating an unjustified risk of death? Yes, of course you are. Because for all you know, there is live ammo in the gun. And if you point a live gun with live ammo at another person and manipulate the hammer and trigger, you're creating an unjustified risk of death, unless you have a justification, like self-defense, which, of course, we're presuming is not here, that there was no justifications for the shooting of Hutchins. And I'm also assuming that Baldwin did not intend to shoot and kill Helena Hutchins, in which case we'd be talking about murder, right? Not manslaughter. So that's what he's been charged with, involuntary manslaughter under New Mexico statute section 30-2-3. So let's go ahead and take a look at that statute. And here it is. Let me blow it up a bit so it's a little easier to read. Now, it's a general manslaughter statute, so it covers both voluntary manslaughter and involuntary manslaughter. Now, voluntary manslaughter is when you intend to cause harm to that other person, intend even to kill them. So why is it not murder? It's not murder because you're in the heat of passion. It's a hot-blooded killing, not a cold-blooded killing. Maybe it was in the course of a fight you were having. The classic example is somebody comes home and finds their spouse in bed with a lover and kills them. That's not a lawful killing. But the law says because of the heat of passion, because of the excited state of the killer, they were incapable of forming the specific intent necessary for murder. We mitigate the offense from murder down to manslaughter. So this statute covers voluntary manslaughter. And here it is. Voluntary manslaughter consists of manslaughter committed upon a sudden quarrel or in the heat of passion. Whoever commits voluntary manslaughter is guilty of a third-degree felony resulting in the death of a human being. So this would normally, it's an intentional killing, would normally be murder, but it's mitigated to manslaughter because of the sudden quarrel or heat of passion. But that, of course, is not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing here with involuntary manslaughter. And there are two paths to involuntary manslaughter under New Mexico law. Involuntary manslaughter consists of manslaughter committed in the commission of an unlawful act, not amounting to a felony, or in the commission of a lawful act, which might produce death in an unlawful manner, meaning without justification, or without due caution and circumspection. And whoever commits involuntary manslaughter is guilty of a fourth-degree felony. So the state here is arguing that if we take the first path to involuntary manslaughter, the commission of an unlawful act not amounting to a felony. Because if you're committing a felony and someone dies as a result, that would just be felony murder. The penalty is the same as murder. But what if you're not committing a felony? You're committing a misdemeanor unlawful act and someone dies as a result. Well, that would not be felony murder. That would be this form of involuntary manslaughter. And the state is arguing one theory of involuntary manslaughter, that Alec Baldwin was handling his firearm negligently. Negligent handling of a firearm under New Mexico law is a misdemeanor. So it's an unlawful act that's a misdemeanor, not amounting to a felony. Someone dies as a result. That would be this first theory of getting Alec Baldwin convicted of involuntary manslaughter. The other path to involuntary manslaughter is that Alec Baldwin was engaged in the commission of a lawful act, but without due caution and circumspection. In other words, he was doing something inherently dangerous, handling a firearm, and he failed to take a practical step to ensure that death would not occur. He failed to make sure there were not live rounds in the gun. That's the without due caution and circumspection. And if either of these are true, then he's guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Now, interestingly enough, the jury does not have to be unanimous on which theory. And I disagree with that. But the law is, if six members of the jury believe that he committed manslaughter in the commission of an unlawful act not amounting to a felony, and six of the jurors believe, well, he didn't commit an unlawful act, he was committing a lawful act without due caution and circumspection, we really don't have 12 juries who agree on one theory. We have two halves of the jury, each half of which agrees on a different theory, believes different facts have been proven, but both theories arrive at involuntary manslaughter. And the law says that's good enough for a conviction on involuntary manslaughter. If I were in charge of things, which I'm not, I would demand that the state has to prove, has to convince the jury unanimously of one theory of guilt. Otherwise, you could have the possibility where, you know, a jury's offered 12 theories of guilt, all distinct from each other, and you're just convincing one individual juror of each theory. And I don't think that's what unanimity in a jury verdict is supposed to mean. Just one guy's opinion. But anyway, that's the statutory framework that we're dealing with respect to Alec Baldwin. Sorry, just trying to get some. Now, generally speaking, anytime you're handling an inherently dangerous instrument and you do it in a negligent manner, that negligence automatically gets bumped up to recklessness. And why is that important? It's important because negligence, mere negligence, so you didn't know you were creating a risk, but you should have known you were creating a risk, and a bad outcome occurred. That's negligence, and it's not enough for criminal liability. It's only enough for civil liability. So you can get sued in civil court for damages, and if they can prove negligence, you're liable for the damages. But you can't be prosecuted for mere negligence. Recklessness is where you know you're creating an unjustified risk and you ignore that risk and you have the bad outcome. That is enough for criminal liability. But if you're engaged in negligent conduct with an inherently dangerous instrument, it automatically gets bumped up to recklessness. What's an inherently dangerous instrument? It could be explosives. It could be dangerous chemicals, dangerous drugs, heavy equipment, or guns. Because in all these categories, these are things that we know if they're handled inappropriately, death or serious bodily injury can readily result. And you're presumed to know that that's the case. So there's nobody in modern society who doesn't know that guns are dangerous, that guns are readily capable of causing death or serious bodily injury. So if you're handling a gun, it's not a negligence standard that's applied, although the law may call it that, but what they really mean is a recklessness standard. Hence the criminal liability. And sometimes they do get sloppy with the terminology. So like New Mexico has a negligent handling of a deadly weapon, misdemeanor crime on the books. But strictly speaking, negligence is not enough for criminal liability. But because it involves a deadly weapon, it's effectively bumped up to recklessness, which is enough for criminal liability. Negligence and recklessness, of course, being states of mind. So how do you know whether or not someone's handling a gun in a responsible way or a reckless way? Well, fortunately, there are well-established rules of gun safety, redundant rules of gun safety, that define what safe handling of a firearm is. And those rules are, one, that all guns are presumed to be loaded until proven otherwise. And that means proven to the person who's holding the gun. Typically, that means he inspects the firearm. But by whatever means, the gun he's holding is presumed to be loaded until demonstrated to him unequivocally there are not live rounds in the gun. And if that gun leaves the holder's hand for even a moment and then comes back, it gets checked again. I've been in groups where guys are showing a gun to each other, 7-8 guys. We're all standing in a circle, just waiting for our turn to get that gun in our hands. We see the guy 2 over from us, check it, unloaded. Hands it to the next guy, 1 over from us. He checks it, unloaded. You get the gun, you check it, unloaded. You hand it to the next guy, he checks it, make sure it's unloaded. That's how that rule works. The second rule, never point the muzzle of a firearm, a real firearm, in anything you're not willing to kill or destroy. 3, never press the trigger of a firearm unless you intend to fire a bullet from the barrel. 4, know your target and what is beyond your target. So don't just shoot over a hill or a can tied in a tree if you don't have a good backstop. That one's not particularly relevant to this particular case. But the first 3 are: the gun's presumed to be loaded until proven otherwise. Don't point the muzzle at anything you're not willing to kill. Don't press the trigger unless you want a loud noise. And the beauty of these rules is that they are redundant. In other words, you could violate one of them and not have a terribly bad outcome. You really need to violate more than one to have a bad outcome. So if you violate just, you fail to check that the gun's loaded, the gun goes off. But the muzzle was not pointed at anything important. Not good that the gun went off, but nobody died. nothing important was destroyed. Or you put your finger on the trigger when you shouldn't, you're not intending for the gun to go off, the gun goes off, or you drop the hammer on the gun. But if there's no ammo in the gun, no bad outcome results. The problem for Alec Baldwin is he violated all of these, all three of these. He did not check to make sure there were no live rounds in the gun. So the gun's presumed to be loaded. He pointed the muzzle directly at Helena Hutchins, which SAG safety rules say you are not supposed to do. I forgot to pull those up again. Let me see if I can find those quickly. I think I did those very early. Do a quick search. Oops. Got it. How good am I? Let me pull this up. Not only is not pointing a muzzle at anything you're not willing to kill or destroy a basic rule of gun safety, and remember, Alec Baldwin's been in 75 movies, many of which involved his handling of guns and the training that comes with that on every movie. Let's see. Here we go. Not only is it a fundamental rule of gun safety, it's in the SAG safety bulletin. Number one, the safety bulletin for firearms is numbered number one. That's how important it is. General safe use and handling of firearms. Refrain from pointing a firearm at anyone. Any object at which you point a firearm could be destroyed. And what did Baldwin do? Baldwin pointed that muzzle directly at Helena Hutchins. Now, we have two safety violations. He didn't check to make sure there was no live ammo in the gun or have someone do it in his presence. And he's pointing the muzzle directly at Helena Hutchins. As far as I'm concerned, that's enough for killing someone in the course of lawful conduct that without due care and circumspection or negligent handling of a firearm right there. Engage in an unlawful act when somebody dies as a result. Either one is involuntary manslaughter. But of course, it gets worse than that. It gets worse because we also have that third rule. Never press the trigger of a firearm unless you intend to discharge it. And we know that Alec Baldwin did exactly that because we saw it in rehearsal and we have the expert testimony coming that this gun, which was functioning properly when it got to the FBI for inspection, examination, so we know it was functioning properly on the movie set, the hammer could not be dropped without the trigger being pressed. And the hammer would need to be fully cocked or it would have fallen into one of the safety notches. In any case, the trigger still needs to be pressed to have the hammer come forward. So, three safety rules violated. That is without due care and circumspection, or it is negligent handling of a firearm, either of which locks in involuntary manslaughter with the death of Helena Hutchins. All right, let's take a look now at we looked at the statute. Let's take a look at the relevant jury instruction. This is the instruction we can expect the jury to get. Blow that up so it's easier to see. Now, the standard, the pattern, New Mexico calls them uniform jury instructions, criminal. They have their own numbers in the jury instruction book. When they're presented in court, the parties will argue for jury instructions. There's many hundreds of jury instructions for different kinds of criminal cases. The parties will argue about which of those instructions they want applied to this particular case on this particular law and facts, and the judge will finalize a list. And when the judge finalizes the list from the ones to be included, they typically renumber them for the convenience of the jury. Just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. I think there were something like 20 or 24 sequentially numbered jury instructions. But the actual identifying number for the jury instruction is what's in the book. That's what we're looking here 14-231, involuntary manslaughter, essential elements, and it's a fill-in-the-blanks kind of form. This is very common for uniform, standardized pattern jury instructions. So let me share with you how I've written this up before when I did an analysis of this jury instruction previously, more than a year ago at this point. Let's see. Where is that? That's here. All right. When we fill in the blanks in that fill in the blank jury instruction with the relevant information from this case, the jury instruction will read as follows to the jury. For you to find the defendant guilty of involuntary manslaughter, the state must prove to your satisfaction beyond a reasonable doubt each of the following elements of the crime. Alec Baldwin pointed a loaded firearm at Ms. Hutchins and depressed the trigger, firing a bullet into her. Do we believe that beyond a reasonable doubt? Is there any contrary evidence? Except for Alec's self-serving statement, that's really not credible, given that he didn't press the trigger. I don't think so. I don't think his self-serving statement is enough to create reasonable doubt, contrary to the other evidence in this case. Secondly, Alec Baldwin should have known of the danger involved by his actions, pointing a loaded firearm. Remember, the firearm's presumed to be loaded, unless proven otherwise. Should have known of the danger involved by his actions. Well, yes, anybody would know that pointing a loaded firearm at another human being creates a risk, a danger of death or serious bodily injury, especially when you pull the trigger. Alec Baldwin acted with willful disregard for the safety of others. The willful merely means he could not have not known of the risk. Now, this is where the replica would have saved him. If he'd said, "Holy cow, I thought this was the non-functioning replica," then there is no willful disregard of the risk because there's no known risk. There's no reason to believe you're creating the risk. But here, as we saw, he knew he was holding a real gun. And that Alec Baldwin's act caused the death of Ms. Hutchins. There's no question about that. It's the bullet fired from his gun that struck her directly and killed her. And this happened in New Mexico on or about the 21st day of October, 2021. Just with the evidence we know now, is there any way that Alec Baldwin escapes conviction for involuntary manslaughter on the legal merits? Now, juries are dangerous and unpredictable creatures. We never really know for sure what they're going to do. But if they act on the legal merits, this is a lock conviction for Kerry Morrissey, special prosecutor in this case on involuntary manslaughter with regard to Alec Baldwin. Now, I do want to touch on something else because people talk about this all the time. I think it's mostly Alec Baldwin's PR team, which has been very active on social media. These little low follower count accounts on social media raising all kinds of legally nonsensical arguments about why Alec Baldwin should not be held accountable. And the biggest one of these is that, hey, he's just an actor. He's just an actor. He's not a gun guy. It's not his responsibility to make sure there's no live rounds in the gun. That's the armorer's responsibility. And after her, it's the first AD, David Halls. He's the general umbrella person responsible for safety on the set. Not an actor. You can't expect an actor to be responsible for that kind of thing. Except, folks, when we look at the manslaughter statute, where's the exception for actors, for Hollywood sets? There is none. This manslaughter law applies to everybody. You don't get to kill people recklessly on a movie set and not have it be involuntary manslaughter just because you're an actor. As Jason Bowles would say, an A-list actor. And as Kerry Morrissey would say, really? A-list? She did that twice during Hannah's trial. Very funny. Yeah, she's not cowed by Alec Baldwin, that's for sure. So there's no exception for Hollywood here. And of course, we do know that someone else loaded the live round into the gun, that Hannah Gutierrez loaded the live round into the gun. That's what the overwhelming evidence. She said that herself. She loaded the gun. Hannah Gutierrez said, Hannah Gutierrez, me, loaded that gun before I handed it onto the set as a cold gun. Now, she said she loaded 6 dummy rounds, but of course, we know that's not true because a live round from the gun killed Helena Hutchins. So we know there was a live round in the gun. Unless you believe that in that small church interior with 8, 10, 12 people in there. The camera crew, the cinematographer, Helena Hutchins, who would die, Joel Souza, who'd be shot in the shoulder, script supervisor, Mammy, wardrobe, David Halls, Alec Baldwin, the other people too, special effects, lighting. With all those people in there, we would have to believe that David Halls opened up the loading gate, pulled the hammer to half cock, rotated that cylinder, took out a dummy round, and slipped in a live round in front of all those people. Or we'd have to believe that, you know, that's it. Nobody believes that. There's zero evidence of that. And of course, a reasonable doubt has to be based on reason, not speculation or conjecture. The absence of evidence. So there's no exception. But on an emotional level, on a court TV, estrogenic legal analysis level, you might say, well, it seems unfair. It seems unfair that it was someone else who put the live bullet in the gun. New Mexico law does not care. Does not care who put the bullet in the gun. And we know this because we have case law on this from the Supreme Court of New Mexico, State v. Gilliam. And if we scroll down to the relevant portion of this decision, it addresses this topic explicitly. Now, this involved a involuntary manslaughter conviction where someone claimed that they didn't load the gun. Someone else loaded the gun, and therefore they should not be responsible for involuntary manslaughter when the gun was in their hand and discharged and killed somebody. So the relevant portion of that case is here. This is the New Mexico Supreme Court. It could have made no difference to the trial of a charge of involuntary manslaughter as to who loaded the gun. All that is necessary to establish for involuntary manslaughter by the use of a loaded firearm is that a defendant had in his hands a gun which at some time had been loaded, and that he handled it without due caution and circumspection, and that death resulted. And of course, the due caution and circumspection is the lack of that, is the pointing the muzzle at another human being without ensuring there was no live ammo in the gun, and then dropping the hammer with the trigger. This is the Alec Baldwin case, folks. Exactly. See if there's... Oh, yes, another thing I wanted to touch on. Other people did things wrong here and have been held criminally liable. First Assistant Director David Halls took a plea deal. Negligent handling of a firearm. Misdemeanor. Sentenced to 6 months unsupervised probation. Now, he got that deal because he took the plea. He didn't compel the state to take him to trial. And as Kerry Morrissey said, when you do that, you get the benefit of taking that plea and not making us go through the effort of convicting you in a week-long trial. Hannah Gutierrez, of course, the armorer who loaded the live round into the gun and handed it onto the set as a purportedly cold gun, was just held criminally liable yesterday, convicted of involuntary manslaughter, immediately remanded into jail, will be sentenced in April sometime, looking at a maximum of 18 months, which, by the way, is also the maximum that Alec Baldwin's looking at. Lawsuits are flying everywhere. So I guarantee you a lot of money is going to be changing hands in civil lawsuits as well, particularly against the production company. The production company's already been fined $100,000 by New Mexico's version of OSHA, but there could be millions of dollars in settlements and legal civil liability being found in this case. So yeah, lots of people have responsibility and lots of people are being held accountable in different ways. But it's important to understand that what we're talking about here is not one giant pie that is split up among different people. And when it's already been split up enough, there's no liability left for Alec Baldwin. That's not how it works. Every individual has their own pie of liability. First Director David Halls, 100% liable for his conduct. And Hannah's 100% liable for her conduct. And Alec Baldwin is 100% liable for his conduct. His liability, his criminal culpability does not diminish because other people also played a role. If the facts of the case are enough to prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that either he was engaged in the unlawful act of negligent handling of a firearm when his conduct killed Helena Hutchins, or he was handling that gun without due care and circumspection when he killed Helena Hutchins with that gun. And I don't think there's really much contest in either one of those. All right. Let's take a look at the questions we now have. We answer questions first from our Law of Self-Defense members for free. The good news is it's easy to be a Law of Self-Defense member. You can become a member for just 99 cents, a two-week trial membership for 99 cents. You're instantly emailed directions for how to access the member live stream and the member chat, and that's where I go to answer questions and comments for free. When the 2 weeks expires, if you remain a member, and just about everybody does, it's still dirt cheap. It's only about 30 cents a day, folks. Less than $10 a month to be a Law of Self-Defense member. Get all your legal questions and comments answered for free on our live streams. If you don't want to do that, which I don't get, I mean, if you're here, it must mean you like the content. Why wouldn't it be worth 30 cents a day? But that's your call to make. Fair enough. You can, if you just want to stay on YouTube, you can post questions and comments on YouTube, and I'll address those too if they're in the form of a minimum $10 super chat. I don't know why you'd spend $10 for one question when for 10 bucks a month, you can get a month's worth of questions answered, but that's your call to make. So first, the Law of Self-Defense members. Let's see what we have. By the way, a lot of the members I know do actually watch the live stream on YouTube because they can do stuff like rewind and participate in polls, but chat in the member chat so they get their questions and comments answered for free. So you can take that kind of blended approach, and I know many people do. Let's see. Law Self-Defense member Philip says, I suspect if Baldwin is found guilty, the production insurance claims will be denied. When the civil lawsuits hit, Baldwin and his co-producers may have a lot of their money riding on this trial outcome. Any personal insurance Baldwin would have would be done. If he's convicted, then if you're proven guilty in a criminal court, it's basically assumed that you're liable in civil court, right? Because guilty in a criminal court is proof beyond a reasonable doubt, a very high threshold. Liable in civil court is only 51%. So if you've been proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, that's well past 51%. They've well exceeded the threshold for civil liability. But there's going to be a lot of layers of insurance here. I mean, movie production is a very complicated, lots of rounds of financing and different corporations, and I'm sure it's going to be a hot mess. And the civil litigation attorneys, guys like my friend Kurt Schlichter, are going to make a lot of money off this case for sure. Let's see. Yeah, a bunch of people missed the verdict live. I managed to catch a live stream of the verdict yesterday. How lucky was that? I mean, I did prepare for it, but I just barely caught it. But I put the replay of my coverage up on the Law of Self-Defense, the blog version of this content, the playback version of my content for the members. Let's see. David says, seems like an unusually competent jury. Now, I did see a very brief sidewalk interview with one of the jurors. I wonder if I can pull that up quickly. Did I save that? I should have saved it. Well, I'll be disappointed if I didn't save it in a bookmark. Let me see. Maybe I did save it. All right. So let's watch this. It was on Twitter. This is one of the jurors, and it turns out he's an expert in safety in the Los Alamos area, which is not far from Santa Fe. Famously enough, Los Alamos, of course. Very pretty, by the way. Not much of New Mexico is pretty, in my opinion, but Los Alamos is in the northern part where there's trees and stuff. It's very nice. But it's a sidewalk interview with this guy. So let's hear what he has to say.
What have been your overall thoughts about the trial, everything you heard throughout these 10 days?
Pretty much very unsafe conditions. And it was obvious. I mean, there was nothing you couldn't miss.
While you guys were in there, it was pretty quick that you guys came to a decision. You know, what was the things that you guys took into consideration, and was the thing that really convinced you guys that she was guilty?
It was a lot of the safety issues that she could have paused work, stopped, cleared it all up, and just never did.
I deal a lot with safety up there. I work in Los Alamos, so I deal a lot with it. And they'd say, you don't stop work, just pause work.
Was there a particular witness or a particular moment, a piece of video, something that the prosecution said that really sank in with you?
Pretty much it was just that never did the safety checks. Never checked the rounds, to pull them out, to look at them, shake them. I mean, if you'd have done that, this wouldn't have happened.
Was there any moment that anyone in the jury maybe didn't agree with the guilty verdict?
They had their ideas or their concerns, but after talking it all out, it pretty much, they were convinced.
How do you feel about the decision today?
I think it was fair. Yeah. And if someone died, I mean, you got to take responsibility, especially when you're handling weapons and you're in charge of those. That's your job.
Inherently dangerous instruments, right? It's not just that somebody died, because people can die by accident without criminal culpability on anybody's part. But once it happens because you're handling weapons and it's your job to make sure those weapons have no live rounds, then you bump up to a strict liability kind of environment, that recklessness instead of mere accident or mere negligence.
Lack of experience or whatever you want to call it, you took the job.
How was much this a difficult decision for you to come to?
The what?
Was this a difficult decision for you to come to?
Yeah, no. Well, after hearing everything and then thinking about it, mostly because I deal with a lot in safety, being in Los Alamos and all the things around, and being in other jobs that were the same way, especially driving with CDL driver, I have to check in my vehicle, make sure I'm not going to slam into people or do something like that. That was her job, to check those rounds, those firearms. And if no one wanted to pay attention or do that, then she could stop the work.
Was there anything that the defense said that maybe convinced you or made you think that Hannah Gutierrez Reed was actually being scapegoated?
No, I don't think so.
Do you believe she brought live rounds on set?
If she did, if she didn't know it, and she did, but yeah, we think she did.
How much? But it doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter if she brought the live rounds in. If everybody in that cast of crew had brought live ammo to the set, if there was a mountain of live ammo on that set, none of this happens. If Hannah Gutierrez simply does her job, and when she preps the gun for the set, she ensures that gun, those six cylinders, those six chambers in that cylinder, have no live rounds in them. That's it. That's why the checks are required. That's why they rattle the dummies when you shake them, or they have a hole in them, or there's a primer missing. Because it's always possible that a live round could get its way into that gun. That's why we care. That's why we do the inspections. That's why we have an armorer.
If at all, did actor Alec Baldwin play a part in your deliberations, or any other cast or crew members that were in there?
Well, they're going to have their day, his day, so we really didn't take that into consideration. It wasn't part of it.
What was her reaction when the decision came down?
I don't know. I didn't see nothing. I didn't look at her. So I don't know. I'll sit in the back. That's about it.
Can you spell your name for us?
ALBERTOSANCHEZ.
Thank you,
Mr. Sanchez. Alberto Sanchez?
Yeah.
Thank you, Alberto.
Thanks, sir.
All right. By the way, there was a very interesting tweet that I thought was interesting. Let's see if I can find it now. Here it is. Let me pull it up. It was by a LawTuber whose legal analysis I've disagreed with before. There are some law tubers are excellent and some are perhaps not as excellent, but I thought this was very telling, and this happens to be a female lawyer law tuber, and we know that Court TV's audience is 90% female, and so they tend to spin things in a very, they do their quote-unquote legal analysis from a very feminine estrogenic, emotional type of perspective, which is why their polls and chat tends to be so different than my community. But here it is. It's this. So this is, of course, the guy we just watched. Legal Bites says, I keep thinking about this juror and how huge an error it was that the defense didn't strike him from the jury, given his background with someone like that present, his background in safety. It's no wonder it was a quick guilty verdict. So a couple things here. One is, of course, if you're a defense counsel and you know this guy's, you know, an expert in safety, you're going to strike him. If you have a peremptory strike, a strike you can use without having to give a reason, you're going to strike him. But what's that say about your client? Because there's nothing about this guy that says he can't be unbiased, fair, impartial. What you're saying is your client can't risk an objective, impartial safety expert evaluating her conduct because he's going to conclude that it was unsafe without due care and circumspection. So what you're saying when you strike this safety expert is you're saying your client's guilty. And this guy, he's not going to railroad your client. He's going to rationally conclude that your client needs to be convicted. And if you're a defense counsel, of course, that's what you're trying to prevent. So defense counsel is not unbiased and impartial. Defense counsel wants to bias everything in their client's favor. That's what they should do. But if you're doing legal analysis on this case, you're now part of the defense team. You have to understand that when you say, you can't believe this guy was allowed in the jury, he should have been struck, you're conceding the guilt of Helena Gutierrez, of involuntary manslaughter. That's what you're saying. And hence my comment there at the bottom. On what grounds would you strike this juror, assuming you had to provide grounds, right? You didn't have any more peremptory strikes. On what grounds, what rationale would you provide to the court saying, we want this guy struck for cause? Except that if he believed your client had recklessly killed someone, he'd be likely to convict her for recklessly killing someone. There's nothing about this juror that indicated he couldn't be fair or impartial. And no defendant is entitled to a jury that consists only of people that would be unwilling to rightfully convict. The jury is just supposed to be unbiased, impartial. It doesn't mean they can't have an understanding of what safety is when you're charged with a crime that alleges unsafe conduct. Very interesting how people have different views of similar subject matter. All right, let me get back to the member comments here. Member David says it's tragically sad because it was so preventable, 100% preventable, right? And we know that. Well, how do we know that? Because real guns are used on movie and TV sets maybe a million times a year. And we've had 5 or 6 fatalities in 100 years of filming. So this doesn't have to happen. It's prevented 99.999% of the time because the safety rules are followed, which is precisely what Hanna Gutierrez violated. And that's why we have the death. Chris says, hello from New Braunfels, Texas. Yes, I like that part of Texas. Jeffrey says, I'm taking a vacation in Fredericksburg this year. Around the corner. Yeah, I like Fredericksburg quite a lot. I like Bernie, Fredericksburg, that whole area of Texas. I'll be in San Antonio, by the way, in about a month. Less than a month, 3 weeks. I'll be in San Antonio in 3 weeks in the Bernie area and downtown. I'm staying downtown San Antonio, but I'll be traveling around the Bernie area. So if you see a guy on a GS motorcycle that looks like this, do I still have the picture up? Or did I close it? I guess I closed it. Oh, that's too bad. Let's see. Did I just have it on my desktop? So if you see a guy riding around San Antonio on the like the third week of March on a bike that looks like this, go ahead and give a wave. That'll be me. I'll have big metal boxes in the back of the bike, panniers on the bike. That's how I usually travel, but that is my motorcycle. So give a wave and don't hit me, please. Member Robert says, I did not follow the whole case. What was the evidence that Hannah loaded a live round into the revolver? The evidence comes from Hannah Gutierrez, who told police, I'm the one who loaded the gun. I loaded 5 rounds before lunch because the chamber needed to be cleaned. Then after lunch, I cleaned the chamber and I loaded the 6th round. And then she took that gun, handed it onto the set in the church as a cold gun. And by her own testimony, within 5 or 10 minutes, the gun discharged and killed Helena Hutchins. So unless you believe David Halls or Alec Baldwin in the company of 10, 12 other people inside that small church, put the hammer on half cock, opened the loading gate, rotated the cylinder, took out a dummy round, reached in her pocket, inserted a live round, lowered the hammer gently back into the safety position. Unless you believe David Halls or Alec Baldwin did that, they were the only other two people who could have handled the gun before the discharge. Then the live round had to come from Hannah Gutierrez. That's the evidence recorded in her police interrogation. Distin says, do you think Baldwin will try to keep cameras out of the courtroom? I would certainly try if I were him, but I sure hope he's not going to be successful. There's no reason why he should be. Jeffrey says, you need to give Emily a lot of quality time after these 2 weeks. We do have some family travel coming up, so she's going to be well rewarded. I'll tell you all about it when we get back. For the members, by the way, that means there's going to be some pre-recorded content coming out pretty soon. I'm in the process of recording it all now, so I don't have to do it while I'm traveling. Let's see. Member Jeffrey said, even if Baldwin said he thought he was holding the replica, the state could still attack that by bringing people in who would say he always wanted his hero gun. Yeah, maybe. And the state could say, well, you need to confirm it's the replica. You can't just assume it's the replica any more than you can assume the gun's unloaded. So yeah, claiming the replica is not a lock defense, but it would have been really helpful. And it would have made the state's narrative, it would have made the defense narrative much more sympathetic. Member Lou says, can Hannah request a retrial due to incompetent representation? Sure, of course, you can always do that. Ineffective assistance of counsel. And I think she'd have pretty good grounds for that argument, to be honest with you. Especially the fact that the defense screwed up having a competent firearms expert available to testify. Instead, the guy they used was the guy who muzzled the entire courtroom and pointed the gun, arguably the Denick's gun, but who knows, the muzzle of that gun right at the judge's head. So I think there's grounds for arguing ineffective assistance of counsel. Jason Bowles was terrible, especially in that interview, that second interrogation where he just sat there taking a lot of notes, chortling at Detective Alexandra Hooters Hancock when he discovered she had been a Hooters waitress before being a police officer. The trouble is, Hannah's only doing 18 months, effectively from today. So she was remanded yesterday. They sentenced her in April, but she'll get credit for time served. So really, it's 18 months from today. It'll take much more than 18 months for any appeal to be heard. And if the appeal is heard and you have a positive outcome, meaningful relief, which happens less than 1% of the time, what do you get? You get a new trial. So she gets to go through all this again? For what? She'll already have served the 18 months. What's she getting out of? Now, she could arguably get out of the felony conviction. The trouble is, given the overwhelming evidence in this case, if she'd had competent counsel, would the verdict be different? Or is this error on the part of her lawyers, but harmless error? And I think the appeals court would just say it's harmless error. The evidence against her was overwhelming. Competent counsel would not have helped her. For example, I expect Alec Baldwin's counsel to be much more effective than Jason Bowles, and I still expect him to get convicted on the merits. Let's see. No, the defense witness list for Alex Kate trial is available. I just haven't pulled it up. I'll cover it at some future show. Let's see. Bump, bump, bump. Safety rule number 5. Make sure you point the gun at a sitting judge. Yeah, let's not do that. Philip says the 4th rule may be relevant. The bullet passed through one person and hit another. I mean, there was no safe direction here. So yeah, it was violated, but it's kind of a given. Uh, Member Kyle says, didn't the state's experts say that even with a broken sear, the hammer would have stopped at half cock if the trigger wasn't pulled? Right. That's right. So the trigger had to have been pulled. Ryan says, I wish you, Andrew, could testify for the state in the Baldwin trial so that you can help ensure Baldwin is convicted. What do I know? I have no personal knowledge of this case, and my area of expertise wouldn't be relevant. There's no justification claim here, so there'd be no role for me. Donnie asked, did the prosecution present evidence of the accuracy of the firearm so that she could argue the bullet went exactly where Baldwin was pointing? The distance is so short, it wouldn't be a relevant factor. Distance says, not all wheel guns have that. A revolver he has had no half cock at all. Yes, but this gun did. So that's what's relevant. Morrissey is going to eat Baldwin alive. She's very good. I really like Carrie Morrissey as a lawyer. She's very disciplined, smart, focused, organized, knows what she wants to do. She's not perfect. She made mistakes in this trial. When she was arguing and closing for the evidence tampering, she didn't mention the weeks of text messages Hannah sent trying to recover the powder she claimed was not a drug. That's the circumstantial evidence that's required to have any hope that the jury would have convicted on the evidence tampering. That's the purported cocaine event. And I think she missed a big opportunity when a number of witnesses during the state's case in chief were asked, did they feel that the set was safe? Did they feel that Hannah was doing her job? And they asked a couple of the crew, and they asked one, maybe an actor, or maybe I just saw that in the Jensen Ackles interview, and he didn't testify in the trial. But when people were asked, they said, yeah, I wasn't afraid. Now, there were a couple of people who were concerned about guns being left out. That was in there, too. But there were people who said, I felt safe, which is not helpful for the state, right? It's helpful for the defense. And Carrie should have followed up and said, well, that was then, before Helena was killed. Has your opinion changed now that there's a dead person? And of course, they would have said, yeah. No, well, now we know it wasn't safe. She's very good. I've said before, I say it again. In fact, I was just talking with Adam Baldwin just yesterday as a verdict came in. He reached out to me to talk about the case, share some thoughts he had. And I told him, as I've told others, listen, if I'm ever charged with murder in New Mexico, I'm hiring Carrie Morrissey as my defense counsel. She's sharp. She's good. Imagine us as a team. Jeffrey says, you need to look at, do a show about Arizona HB 2843. Seems to expand curtilage to your whole property. You know, I'm not going to remember that from here, and I have to run out right after the show. But if you email support@lawselfdefense.com and tell them to tell me to look at it, you know, include the bill number and ask them to forward the message to me, they'll do that. And then I'll be sure to look into it. Let's see. Yeah, in Arizona, because of all the illegal migrants, illegal immigrants, illegal aliens. Kyle writes, I dropped in an EDB, that would be Emily Baker's stream, and the whole lot seemed to dislike the prosecutor, but ultimately agreed with the conviction. Yeah, nobody hates women like women. They're the worst. By the way, Emily Baker, whatever you want to say about her show or coverage of this, she's enormously successful LawTuber, content creator on YouTube. Very successful. I'm sure that if I were able to take a kind of a feminine legal analysis approach, I probably have a couple hundred thousand subscribers too, but I just don't know how to do that. I just do straight up legal analysis. DJ says never interrupt a safety task. Yeah, that's right. By the way, a couple of times I've lost stuff off my motorcycle on motorcycle trips, like a bag of stuff. Sometimes expensive stuff. And I don't know until my next stop, which is, you know, a couple hours down the road, and then I have to ride back and look for the bag, and I never find it. And when that happens, it's typically because I was packing up my gear on the bike and I got interrupted. Someone came up and started chatting about motorcycles, or I got a phone call, and that interruption prevented me from completing my normal process to make sure everything was adequately insured. Of course, all I lost in those cases was a bag of stuff. But yeah, with guns, people can die. Yeah, even Joel Souza said they felt she was doing a good job. By the way, they probably have to say that, right? Because if they were to say now, no, we were really worried about her, but they left her in the position, imagine what that would do to their civil liability. So they pretty much have to say that they thought she was safe. But they would. None of these people, David Halls, Joel Souza, none of them know anything about guns. So if she appears to be going through the motions, they wouldn't know any different. Eric, yeah, Jason Bowles, defense attorney, was so disingenuous about the second charge, the tampering charge, the cocaine stuff, on its closing, saying there can be no evidence tampering charge if we don't have the evidence. No. The tampering is the destruction of the evidence. So, of course, you don't have it, but it was destroyed. And if there's circumstantial evidence that it was evidence, the jury could conclude tampering. I think that was a missed opportunity by Kerry to fail to talk about the text messages. I think if somehow Hannah had been acquitted on the manslaughter, she really would have regretted that oversight, but it worked out okay. Even if she'd been convicted on both the manslaughter and the tampering, it still would have been a maximum sentence of 18 months. It would have been two 18-month sentences served concurrently. All right, so let me check if there's any super chats. Need to be $10 super chats if you want me to read them. I wish you wouldn't do that. I wish you would instead become a law of self-defense member. That's the smart thing to do. Just 99 cents, folks, to try it out for 2 weeks. Less than $10 a month after that. About 30 cents a day. That's what I would recommend. Let's see. Gregory Narramore on YouTube, $10. Thank you very much, Gregory. Much appreciated. He asks, instructions require the element of willful disregard as an element of the crime. Was there willful disregard? Yeah, because the willful can be an act of either commission or omission. So it just means you know you have the option to do it and you choose not to do it. So the act, the willful act of omission by Alec Baldwin is he knows he can ask for the gun to be cleared in his presence to make sure there's no live rounds in it. Anybody can. A crew member could do that. Alec Baldwin knows he can do that. He's the most powerful man on the set. So that's the act of omission. He did not commit the act of making sure the gun was not loaded. Doesn't mean he has to handle the ammo. You call over the armorer who is right outside the church, call her in, say, here, I need you to unload this for me. I want to know these are dummies. Shake them so I can hear the rattle. Show me the hole. Show me no primer, and then we'll load those six back into the gun, and we're good. So that was the act of omission. The act of commission was pointing the muzzle at Helena Hutchins while depressing the trigger. That's willful. So none of these things are unconscious. They're all known, or you have to presume to be known. He knows he's allowed to have the gun inspected for safety. Anybody can do that. Goes a fire truck. I can't wait to get out of this office. Move into my new office in Huntsville, Alabama. Or maybe Louisville, Kentucky. Or maybe Texas Hill Country. Or Florida. We haven't decided yet. Florida and Texas are looking pretty, have fallen in priority. All right, folks, that's all the questions I have for everybody today. That's our show. So I'll just remind all of you, not sure if there'll be a show tomorrow, Friday, by the way, folks. I have to check in with the wife. I've been spending 15 hours a day plus on this Hannah Gutierrez trial. There's other stuff I need to catch up on. So it's possible there may not be a show tomorrow. We'll see. But if not tomorrow, definitely there'll be one on Monday. In any case, if you carry a gun, so you're hard to kill, that's why I carry a gun. So I'm hard to kill. So my family is hard to kill. If that's what you do for those reasons, then you also owe it to yourself and your family to make sure you know the law so you're hard to convict as well. Until next time, I remain Attorney Andrew Branca for the Law of Self-Defense. Stay safe.